Once upon a time, a special coffee brand was born, Enchant Coffee. They believe that a good brew should be part of every good story. Enchant Coffee is a gourmet, fairy tale themed coffee company that offers flavors like Mad Tea Party, Potion of the Sea Witch, The Sleeping Curse, and The Enchanted Bean. Each is a unique blend of 100% Arabica coffee. Sign up for the newsletter at enchantcoffee.com to receive 10% off your first order. Enchantcoffee.com. Add some magic to your morning.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. The Russian folktale Snegurochka, or the Snow Maiden, is something of a curious one. There are various versions of the tale, type 703 in the Arne Thompson Index for those who like those things, in which a girl is made of snow and subsequently comes to life. It seems like an old story, but there don't seem to be any roots far back in Slavic traditions, and it only appears in folklore in Russia in the 19th century. But the concept soon took hold after it did appear. There have been multiple treatments of the idea of the Snow Maiden since that time. In 1878, the Tsar's Imperial Ballet staged The Daughter of the Snows. Rimsky-Korsakov adapted the story as an opera. Two films came out of the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s, one animated and one live action. The latest iteration of the tale comes from the pen of award-winning children's author Sophie Anderson, and is called, simply, The Snow Girl. Long-time listeners to the podcast will remember that Sophie has been here before, talking about one of her previous books, The Girl Who Speaks Bear. All of Sophie's books draw on folk and fairy tales, due in no small part to the influence of her Prussian grandmother, who told Sophie stories when she was a girl. In The Snow Girl, which is beautifully illustrated by artist Melissa Castron, Tasha builds a snow girl with her grandpa, and above everything else, wishes that the snow girl could become real, so that she could have her as a friend, and not feel so alone. And then, after a meeting with the magical Alyana, something amazing happens. I spoke with Sophie recently about the story of the Snow Girl, along with her other folklore writing influences. So, welcome back to the Folklore Podcast, Sophie Anderson. It's lovely to have you back again. I think the last time we spoke was pre-plague.
Yes, I think it was, wasn't it? I think it was for the house for chicken legs, if I remember right. Or maybe for bear. I don't. It was years ago, wasn't it?
It was for bear. It was for bear.
A while ago. But, no, it's lovely to be back, Mark. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, welcome. And you are here to talk to us about your new book, obviously, The Snow Girl, but also about the folklore and the inspiration behind it, just as importantly as far as our listeners are concerned, because that's what will make them all go out and buy a copy of the book. So before we do that, though, we've probably covered this a little bit before, but it was some time ago. So for those that haven't listened to the previous episode, just paint a little bit picture of your kind of path to this point. Tell us, how did you go from kind of young Sophie at school, full of hopes and dreams about the future, to this path to now Sophie and giving all sorts of other children hopes and dreams for the future through your writing? What got you here?
Gosh, it was quite a winding path. So at school, I loved science, actually. I grew up in Swansea by the seaside, and I loved, I loved mermaids, actually, and sea monsters and marine biology. There was a bit of an overlap there between the mythical beasts and the real one. But I wanted to go to university to study marine biology, which is what I did. Although in the first year, we were asked to dissect creatures, because this is like ages ago when they did these things, and I didn't like that. So I swapped to geology, because I thought rocks won't complain if you you know, break them open and look inside. So I became a science, well, I became a geologist. I worked as an exploration geologist for a while. Then I worked as a science teacher. And what happened was when I was 30, I had children, and this kind of changes everything, doesn't it? And I had a little bit of time off teaching, and I started to think about what I wanted to pass on to my children. And I think all of us start to think about stories then, don't we, about the stories that meant a lot to us growing up, and we kind of want to pass those on to our children. And the stories that meant the most to me growing up were the stories my grandmother told me. She was a Prussian lady, which said that the place where she was actually born is now in Poland, and where she went to school is now in Russia, because, you know, all these borders changed after World War II, and they still continue to change, don't they? So my grandmother left Eastern Europe after the Second World War, came to Wales. And she left with nothing, like lots of people did back then. But she had the stories from her past, from her culture, and the music and the food and like the recipes. And that was what was really important to her. And she really made me love them as a child. I used to love going to her house in Pontypridd in South Wales. And it was like this little pocket of Eastern Europe in Pontypridd. And she would sit at her piano and tell me stories, Slavic fairy tales and folk tales in her own way. And she'd punctuate them with a bit of music, a bit of Eastern European music. And I loved that. And sadly, she died when my eldest was less than one, I think. And I think this really... It kind of highlighted for me. It was like I want to pass on those stories to my children, you know. And the first 10 years I was writing, I wasn't published. I was literally writing these stories in different ways for my children. But I think, you know, if you write, I found a great love of writing, and eventually, once you've produced lots of stuff, I think it's only natural to start to think, well, it might be nice to be published and spread these stories around a little bit further than my own family. So. Yes,
it's important, isn't it, as well, to spread these stories. It's not just to preserve the stories, but it's the mechanism by which we teach people all sorts of different things as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think I said to you just before we started, I've been having lots of Zooms today, but I've talked a lot about this, about how fairy tales and folk stories are so important to impart that knowledge, the knowledge from our ancestors. I think, you know, I think it is vital knowledge about what it means to be human. And it's been wrapped up in these imaginative little easy to digest pockets of stories. But within them is some really deep and vital wisdom, I think, that it is important to pass on. And also culturally, like I remember, I grew up in South Wales, but I was hearing these stories from Eastern Europe. And I remember vividly the first time I actually saw one of those stories in a book. It was in Joan Aiken's book, The Kingdom Under the Sea, and there's a Baba Yaga story in there. And it was, for me, it was just like, these stories that my grandmother told me, they're not just my grandmother's stories, they are part of a wider, you know, culture of stories. And I felt it was wonderful. And I think I've written 5 books now, and all of them are inspired by Slavic fairy stories. And I always find it wonderful when people get in touch and they say, you know, these stories mean a lot to me from my family. Most, you know, they'll be British people. A guy from Wales got in touch the other day, but he's of Russian descent. And he was talking about how the stories meant so much to him. And it was so wonderful for him to see them in contemporary British literature. And it reminded me about, you know, how much it meant to me to find those stories in a book too.
Yeah. So is it the case that you chose to work in this area, sort of magical stories, fairy stories, or your interpretations of them, purely because of your family background, or because that was a mechanism that allowed you to tell the stories that you wanted to tell?
I think those stories meant the most. I love all fairy stories, and I remember finding the fairy story section in my local library in Swansea, and I loved reading stories from lots of different cultures. But I think I had this deep connection to the stories from Eastern Europe because my grandmother told them to me. And when I started to write, it was always those stories that inspired me, even in the books that, you know, my early books that weren't published. It was Polish fairy stories and Russian fairy stories, all the Slavic ones, because I think I just feel this connection to my personal heritage. So they do feel quite personal to me. I do love them anyway. I think I'd love them if I wasn't from, if my heritage wasn't from that part of the world. And I love all sorts of stories. But there is something, I think, about telling stories that mean a lot to you personally. You know, I think, yeah, so yes, indeed. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think having that connection, you know, to a personal connection to it, it helps the story to develop as well, doesn't it? So let's talk about the story that you've chosen to work with this time. So your book is titled The Snow Girl, and it comes from a traditional Russian fairy tale, Snegurochka, and I will probably have mangled the pronunciation a little more than I would like.
That's pretty good, I think.
Okay, I'll take that as a win.
I can do much better.
I'll take it as a win. The Snow Maiden, if we want to translate it into our own language. It's a relatively well-known fairy tale, I would argue, in many cases, and of course it's provided interpretation for other stories too. So tell everybody a little bit about your story of the Snow Girl, how it comes out of this original fairy tale, and how your version kind of works with that material, as far as you can without spoilers, of course.
Of course, yeah. So in the original, just for people who don't know, very briefly, there's an old couple who are childless and they want a child. So they mould a child out of snow and she comes to life. And then depending which version you read, I mean, eventually at the end of the story, she does melt. Unfortunately, spring comes and she melts. Sometimes she jumps over a fire and she disappears into a puff of cloud. There's a kind of later version, which was a play and then an opera, which is the one that a lot of people know. She's a slightly more grown up child when she falls in love, and that love makes her icy heart melt, and she melts away. So, but there's always this element of she is a person made of snow that has come to life, and at the end she kind of melts. So it represents these kind of seasonal cycles, I suppose, of snowfall and snow melt. And as you said, there's lots of different versions. One of the most popular in recent years, I think, is an adult version called The Snow Child by Ewen Ivey, which is set in Canada, an adult version, which is very beautiful. And I love that book. I love all the different versions. I always have. And I wanted to write a middle grade one specifically, because I couldn't find one, to be honest. I found lots of picture books. I found adult versions. And of course, there's the opera and the play. But I couldn't really find a kind of middle grade children's family version. So that's what I set out to write. It is middle grade, but I did set out. I wanted it to be a story that readers of all ages could enjoy. My children are from 5 to nearly 18 now, and I wanted all of them to be able to enjoy it, and I wanted myself to enjoy it and grandparents to enjoy it. So it's very much I was setting out to write a family story. So in my version, instead of grandparents, instead of parents making the child, my main character is a young girl called Tasha, and she's moved to the far north to her grandfather's farm with her parents to help grandpa out because he's getting on a bit. And she's very lonely at the start of the book because she's quite a shy and nervous character, and she hasn't had the courage to reach out and make any friends in the valley yet. So she makes the snow girl with her grandpa, and she makes a wish that the snow girl will come to life and be her friend so that she feels less alone. And of course, the snow girl does come to life, and they have all these wonderful, wintry, magical adventures over the winter. But the winter starts to go on a bit longer than it should, and people in the valley and animals in the valley start to suffer. And Tasha starts to wonder if perhaps her friendship with the snow girl is making winter go on a bit longer than it should. So then she has to have some important decisions about whether she can do anything to bring spring. And of course, there's the awful thought that if she does bring spring, what will happen to her new best friend who is made of winter? So it's a story about friendship, about reaching out, about letting go. It's about community as well. And I just hope it's a really lovely, wintry, magical fairy tale for all the family to enjoy.
It definitely is. As with all of your books, I demolished it fairly quickly because your writing style I find particularly engaging, and you just want to stick with it because I think you're a natural storyteller in that way, and it keeps you engaged. It's really good, and I think it has such a beautiful denouement as well, this, as all fairy tales should, of course. There has to be a happily ever after And I'm not going to go too much into the detail for obvious reasons, other than, you know, it is a typical fairy tale in that sense. But I think it paints a beautiful picture of how, you know, everybody can come out of events in a positive way. And I think I spoke at the beginning when I flippantly, admittedly, a little bit when I said talking about your hopes and dreams at school and the ones that you give to other people. But that kind of that's all bundled up in this story, isn't it? In that way,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I thought, like all fairy stories, it's about big things that affect us all. And it doesn't shy away from the fact that sometimes, you know, they're scary or upsetting or sad, but it has that, the kind of hopeful feeling of like, we all go through the same thing, so we can support each other through these things. So even if something sad happens or bad happens or scary happens, we can all understand this. We're all humans and we can all support each other. And I think that's what's wonderful about fairy stories, is it helps us to talk about and deal with these big themes, doesn't it? But and in a comforting way, in the same way that a mother or a grandmother or a great-great-grandmother or a great-great-great-grandfather would, you know, hold us through these things and tell us that it can be all right, you know, that we can do this, we can get through these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things that folklore is so good at is you know, this teaching mechanism that allows you to use stories in order to teach those lessons and to say, look, you know, this is how things can be and this is how things have been for other people.
Yeah. It's such a lovely medium to teach those lessons, because it becomes not didactic, you know, because and obviously all these stories are so layered, we all get different things out of them, don't we? So I like to think, because a couple of people have asked today, you know, what's the message that you're getting across? And I always say, well, I just want readers to find their own message. I've threaded lots of ideas and things in there, and it's up to the reader for them to pull out what is important to them.
Yeah,
you know, and I do very much like that idea, which is what folklore, like I say, is all about, people finding their own meaning from the old tales.
Yes, exactly. And I obviously tend to have a focus more on the folklore and the inspiration behind the story than those kind of literary angles of, so why did you write that sentence in that? That's not what we're about. Now, of course, because it's one of your stories, there does have to be a good amount of animal involvement here as well. We've spoken about animals as characters before when we talked about the girl who spoke there. But in this case, I wanted to ask you about your character of the fox. Now, the fox plays quite an important role in your version of this story. When we look at the fox more broadly in terms of folklore, the fox is normally a trickster character in many cultures and in many ways. Your fox is somewhat different to that. Was there a reason that you chose to use that animal in the way that you used it?
It very much a nod to Arthur Ransom, I suppose, actually, because in the earliest versions that I found, there was no fox. But in Arthur Ransom's version, he wrote a version of the Snow Maiden in his book. What's it called? Peter's Russian Tales. There's a version in that, and there's a fox in it. And like you say, he's not a trickster. In that version by Arthur Ransom, that the snow girl gets lost in the woods. And she wants to find her way home, and three animals come and offer her to help her get home. I think it's a bear, a wolf, and a fox. And she says no to the bear because, you know, you might eat me. She says no to the fox because you might eat me. I mean, no to the wolf. And then she says yes to the fox, and the fox actually leads her home. So the fox is very much the helper in that version. And I know the fox featured in Eowyn Ivey's version as well. And so I kind of link the fox to the Snow Maiden. So it's very much a nod to those two. And I did actually find, it really bothered me where that fox came from in Arthur Ransom's version. So I trawled through the original stories. I had a friend help me translate some, and eventually found another version of the Snow Maiden in Alexander Afanasyev's Russian Fairy Tales, which has that section. And it's called The Snow Maiden and the Fox, but it kind of doesn't have the bit of the story where the Snow Maiden's made, but it has that bit with the three animals. So I was delighted when I found it, because I was like, oh, I see now. Arthur Ransom took these two versions and he mushed them together. and that's where that came from. But so I've gone off topic a little bit now. But yes, but basically I put the fox in because it was very much a nod to kind of Arthur Ransom's version of the story. I really liked the idea of the Snow Maiden having an animal companion. As you say, I do like animal companions, and because it was because of Arthur Ransom's version that I chose a fox. Basically, it's a nice colourful animal to have next to the icy white of the Snow Girl as well, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
Visually as well.
Do you enjoy being able to develop a story through characters that are not human? So whether it's in a kind of anthropomorphic animal way or some other twist on us as a species, does that allow you to take things just a little bit further perhaps than you would otherwise be able to?
Yeah, definitely. I do like, because I think, you know, fairy tales and folklore are so rooted in nature, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so it feels right to have animal characters in there. And they're such fun to write as well. In fact, they're nicely challenging to write because they don't speak. Well, in my books, they don't speak. They're not anthropomorphized to that point that they speak.
Yeah.
But so I have to find ways for them to communicate just using gestures and things, which is quite lovely. So they're lovely characters to write, and everyone loves an animal character, you know, to pop into your books.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Lassie, isn't it, for those of us of a certain age, yes, you know, indeed. Or Skippy the bush kangaroo, you know, you've got to follow them because they want to tell you something, and then, yeah.
They're so lovely, you know, and I think children in particular, just like, I think, well, we all do, I think we all love a nice animal character, because Tasha has a little goat that's her favourite, and the Snow Girl has her fox, and there's lots of wild animals that they like to go and look at, so, but yes, it's lovely to pop all that in the book, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So you spoke about your background and your family background and obviously why that is an inspiration for you. But do you think the stories that come out of this area, so, you know, Russian folklore, Slavic folklore, are they particularly good as a source material for stories, for the reinterpretation of stories? Or is it just the case, do you think, that, you know, every culture has these stories of their own culture, and they're all equally good in terms of inspiration, but it's how you develop them yourself as a writer?
It's a little bit of both, you know, because I think all stories definitely have that potential for inspiring and to be reinvented, and I definitely feel that personal connection, which is why I'm drawn to them. But I do think as well that a lot of the Slavic tales, the versions that you find available in books and on the internet, tend to be slightly less messed with than like perhaps the sort of Western European stories. Not to insult the Brothers Grimm, but they did change a lot of the original stories quite a lot, and their versions kind of became the go-to version. So it can be quite difficult now to look further back and find older versions. Whereas I think with the Slavic folklore, it can be a little bit easier to get a kind of sense of some of the more ancient versions, and they're kind of, it is difficult to kind of get their links back to kind of like, you know, I see them all as being linked to pagan Slavic beliefs, and it can be sometimes difficult to find those links, but it is, I think it's slightly easier, possibly just because I spent more time doing it than it would be to do it with a sort of Western European Grimm ones, you know, because there's quite a lot, not loads, but there's a fair amount known about pagan Slavic beliefs. And you can kind of, like, I'm not sure, but I feel echoes of like Marana, who's the Slavic goddess of winter in the Snow Girl, who was a goddess of winter whose death would allow for the rebirth of spring. And to me, that's very much the Snow Maiden, you know, so I can kind of see these links. And I very much like that about them. I like to be able to choose a fairy story, and before I use it, I research it so much. I research all the versions, and I try to get as far back as I can to see if I can see where it came from. And with a lot of the stories in Eastern Europe, you can reach all the way back to, you know, sort of ancient pagan goddesses, which I find just wonderful. I love that about them.
There's a lot of characters in Slavic Eastern European folklore as well that they're not the most pleasant of characters sometimes. Mm. There's a lot of you know, more malicious characters in that folklore, but you can still work with them to your advantage as well, can't you? It's not naturally the case that because folklore depicts a character as being evil or bad or malicious, that mm-hmm. that's everything there is about them. And I'm thinking about, you know, the House of Chicken Legs, for example, the Baba Yaga story. You know, in many cases and in many ways, when you look at the lore behind Baba Yaga, yeah, she's a truly unpleasant character. But she it doesn't is. Have to be that way, does it?
No, she's wonderfully ambiguous. This is, you know, like we might have talked about this before, but I do. I absolutely I love her for that, because she's awful. She's cannibalistic and terrible, and she threatens to eat people and sometimes does eat people. But she can also be benevolent, and in lots of the stories, even though she's this, you know, kind of hideous, scary witch, she does end up giving the heroes or heroines something. She tests them and then gives them something that they need if they're worthy of it. So I think that's wonderful. And I do also, I just said about, you know, the Eastern European stories not being messed with so much, but there is, particularly with Baba Yaga, I think that element of when the Christian patriarchy kind of got into power over there, then they definitely, I think, made Baba Yaga a lot more evil than perhaps she originally was, because they were trying to put people off their pagan gods and goddesses, obviously. So I always kind of, like, when there's a character that's depicted particularly terribly over there, I do kind of remind myself that perhaps that's, you know, a Christian retelling, and they're trying to put people off, you know, those stories. But, you know, even with that element of the stories being changed, I think it still comes through that these characters are very rich and layered and yes, ambiguous. You know, they can be interpreted in lots of different ways. And I think that's something that's really wonderful when you want to reimagine a character, obviously. You know,
because
even in The House with Chicken Legs, I made Baba really quite kind, but nobody said, oh, Baba's not kind, because most people who know Baba Yaga know that she can be kind, even if I didn't, you know, portray the cannibalistic bits. They're kind of aware that Baba can be quite a benevolent character. So, you know, it still works no matter what you do with them, which is great.
Yeah, and cannibalism does tend to fall away in a middle grade book as a rule. It's not usually a big theme.
I think people kind of accept that. It's like, oh, fair enough. We're not going to be cannibals in middle grade. That's not so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you haven't only written for this culture or interpreted the stories of this culture, because you wrote for the MAB, for example, the reimagining of the Mabinogion, which we've covered on the podcast before. Okay. Now, how do you use folklore generally in fiction writing, both for children and adults, as source material? Because, you know, we've spoken a lot about interpreting the Russian fairy tales and that particular culture, but thinking more broadly, you know, are there particular things that you look to do with this sort of source material, or that other people should look to do with it?
A little while ago, I said about research. I think it's really important, if you want to work with it, is to start just by reading everything you can, you know, about a subject, you know, not only because it provides inspiration, but because you also, well, I do want to remain true to the source material, even if I'm going to change things. You know, I do want to, I like to have some justification for the things that I choose. So I have lots of books. I do lots of research. I read every version that I can. I'll read the very clever folklorists who write long things that about the interpretations and what various things might mean and the histories of the stories. And I'll read it all, and I'll let all that sink in, and then I think stories kind of naturally arise from that. If you familiarize yourself with everything around a story, then quite naturally your brain will kind of, you know, sift through it all, and the things that mean the most to you will come to the front, and a story will start to form. Like you mentioned the MAB, and it's actually the first time I'd written a story that wasn't based on Eastern European. And I did know the MAB from when I was a child growing up in Wales, but I wasn't as familiar with it. So I read all the different versions I could of the Mabinogion, and I read modern versions that were written in verse. I read lots of people's thoughts about the history and the meaning of those stories, and slowly, like, my idea of Branwen emerged again. I sort of like researched way back to some people had ideas that Branwen, the character in the story I wrote for the MAB, used to be a goddess again, and so I sort of researched that aspect and what her powers might have been. And just the more you research, I think naturally something comes from that, and you know, and it means that what comes from it is rooted in in the past and in stuff that is already there. So, and that is a reimagining. It's not, you're not just making up. I'm not just taking this character and making them what I want them to be. I am portraying what is the most important parts of that character that is rooted in, you know, in the past. And I think that's what makes them sort of authentic and true to the past, you know. Yeah. I think, you know, but yes, hopefully that makes sense.
yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about translations as well. Now, your books notably have been translated into a number of different languages. And
yes, over 25 now.
Yeah. And you have often on the platform formerly known as Twitter posted images of your book covers from all the different translations, which are always equally as beautiful as the original. Kinds of slight adaptations based on the country that they're going into, and I wondered whether you thought that folklore themed fiction, so fiction that takes its inspiration from folkloric tales, from folk tales, from fairy tales, do you think those books travel particularly well? And at the same time, when they are translated, when they're translated and adapted into other cultures' literary canons,
is there a sense that perhaps they take on a little bit of that culture in the translation, or do you think that they tend to be fairly faithful?
That's a really interesting question, actually. I think a little bit of both again. I've been really interested, like I say, they've been translated into over 25 languages, and most of the translators haven't communicated with me, but a few of them do, and particularly places like Korea and China and Japan, the translators from those countries have got in touch to query and to question various aspects, and partly because the language can be quite different. So they're seeking the right word, whereas we might have one word in English, they have like four words for it, and so they're seeking the right word. But sometimes, like you say, it is about them trying to tweak the story so that it fits the culture, so that people can relate to it a little bit better. And I've had some interesting conversations with the translators saying, right, well, this scene is about, this is what it's about, so can you think of a way of doing that same thing but that your readers will relate to a little bit more, and then we'll come up with something together. And I think I've really enjoyed that, you know, that kind of collaborative working to make sure that I think a straight translation can work, but I think if you have a translator that's making sure that that the essence of the story is going to be understood by a different culture, if there is a bit of a, you know, divide that would make it more difficult for a different culture to understand, I think that's wonderful when that has happened. And I suppose needing those conversations is all about how different is your culture and how different are the points of reference, you know, that different cultures use. So that has been really interesting, actually. But generally, I would say that folklore is something that can travel. I love reading, you know, folklore and folklore-inspired books from all around the world. And I think that we can all get something out of them, even though you might read them and think, gosh, these are quite different culturally to the stories that I know and recognise. It can be actually really refreshing and invigorating and intellectually stimulating to read something that is so different from, you know, the familiar stories that we know.
And other languages are not the only place that your stories have gone, because you have now adapted for the stage as well. For Chicken Legs. What was that process like?
Absolutely wonderful. So there's a company called L'Enfant Terrible, who the theatre company, who got in touch with my agent and said they wanted to adapt it. And I can't really claim any glory for the adaptation. They did a wonderful job. But early on, they kind of asked, you know, how much you want to be involved. But everything they shared with me was just so wonderful. It was just like, I'm just going to let you do it. It just felt right. And they are the experts in theatre, and I am not, obviously. So what they've done is just absolutely incredible. They had an amazing man called Samuel Wye did the puppets, who does a lot of fantastic puppets for theatre. Alexander Wolfe created the musical score that is absolutely beautiful, inspired by Eastern European music again, but with the lots of other influences coming in. And Oliver Lansley, who wrote the script, kept it really, really true to the book, but also made it its own thing, you know, because obviously it needed to fit onto the stage. So He sort of condensed it and distilled it and added a bit more humour, I think, than is in the book, because that obviously translates really well on stage. And they've created something absolutely magical. I'm so very proud of them and so very honoured, you know.
Yeah, and even if you weren't directly involved with that adaptation, did you then have the opportunity, or did you need to have the opportunity, to go and look at it in a kind of finished or semi-finished form and go, yes, that's good, go with that, or actually I don't think that you should treat it in that way, or did you just go do it?
I had the opportunity to at every stage, but I did just say do it. But I think at the point I said do it, it was after I had seen a great deal of what they'd done. They were very open with, they sent me pictures of the sets, pictures of the puppets. They sent me the musical score with just Alexander singing it rather than a full cast, obviously. They sent me set designs and set plans. They offered to send the script, actually, but I think by that point I said no. I trust you, because I'd had so many conversations with them. I talked to Oliver about what his aims and hopes and dreams were, what he felt about the book, what he felt the message was. And you know, when you just click with people and you just think, I just trust them, so I'm just going to let them run with it. And by the time I was offered to read the script, it was just like, you know what, I just actually want to watch it, because I know it's going to be wonderful, because I trust you so much. So sure enough, on opening night, when it was at Manchester first, last year or the year before, and I watched it on opening night with my agent and a few other people. And it was wonderful, and I knew it would be. So I did have complete faith. But like I said, they had shared a great deal up to that point. So yeah, but everything had just been so fine. It was like, yeah, you do that. I didn't want to stand in their way at all. I know what it's like, you know, as a creative, you know, you just need to get your own creative stuff out, don't you? Sometimes it's useful. Obviously, you know, towards the end, editors are wonderful, but in that first draft stage, you just want to be left to, you know, run with your own ideas, yes, without someone questioning them, I think, really. So
yeah, absolutely. And if you're the sort of person who isn't too precious about letting go of control of something that you've created, then absolutely, I think probably you'll enjoy the end result more for that as well. I think if you've been involved at every step of the process and then gone to opening night, there'd have been no surprises. There'd have been little magic to
exactly
it, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, it was lovely to have all those surprises. I mean, possibly it helps that my books are inspired by folklore, because I think that means that I'm not so precious about them, because, you know, I would say they're not. Quite often people who don't know The House of Chicken Legs and Baba Yaga say, oh, how did you come up with that idea? And it's like, well, it's not my idea. They're very old stories. Baba Yaga is a lot older than me. The House of Chicken Legs is someone else's idea. So I it would feel wrong for me to feel precious about these things that are thousands of years old, and they belong to all of us, really. So, yeah, so I think possibly that helps as well.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the great things about folklore as a discipline. I hesitate to use the word discipline, because there's far more to folklore than just the academic study of it.
Mm-hmm,
but for those people who work with folklore, however they work with it, on the whole, they tend to not be precious about their material, their personal material, in quite the same way as a lot of other subject areas do. And I don't know whether, I don't know what the reason is for that. I've never kind of quite pinned it down, whether it's because it's all part of our shared past.
Heritage,
I don't know what it is, but I think that generally tends to be the case with this subject matter.
It's like you said at the start about, you know, the importance of passing on the stories. I think that if you're interested in folklore, I think all of us feel that, you know, that it is important to pass on these stories. So that goes against being precious with them in a way, doesn't it? We do want everyone to read them. We want everyone to read the other versions. You know, we want everyone to know how wonderful it is and can be. So, yeah, perhaps that is part of it.
Yeah, maybe. I have, in the past, on a number of occasions, bemoaned the kind of children's book market for folklore materials. Because it has traditionally not been that great. I think there have been very few books up until relatively recently, perhaps, that worked with folklore as inspiration, as material, as much as perhaps they should. And I think over recent years, that's changed a great deal. And now there are brilliant books and brilliant authors doing the kind of thing that you're doing and working with non-fiction material. Like we had Claire Cox Darkey on recently, who's produced some beautiful children's non-fiction folklore titles, and a number of other people as well. Do you think it's improved? Do you think that there was a kind of... gap in the market almost for this sort of thing, where children were just not able to enjoy this material in the way that they can now, and that actually we're now seeing a much better position?
I think so, definitely. I think, like you say, in recent years we've seen so many wonderful books come out that are much more relevant and exciting to young people today. There seemed to be like this long period, like from when I was a child right up until, like you say, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, where the only fairy tale books were just the same old collections of fairy stories from all over the world, kind of jumbled up together, and they were all quite short, and not wanting to insult them, quite a lot of them were quite blandly written, and it was, you know, just lots and lots of stories shoved into a book of fairy stories. And, you know, and I loved a lot of them, but I think that there was definitely a gap for something new and exciting, and, you know, that appeals to readers today. And like, particularly for the like middle grade and young adult readers, you know, because there's quite a difference between reading a book of short fairy stories and reading a whole novel that is inspired by a fairy story. You get, you know, so much, they become so much richer and deeper and so much more layered. And in recent years, I think there have been some really fantastic reimaginings and retellings, really exciting ones, you know, that are subversive, and just like everything that that is brilliant about fairy tales and folklore. So it is very exciting, but there's definitely room for more still.
There really is. Yeah, but judging by the people who contact me and my to be read and reviewed pile, there's lots more, you know, on the way fairly soon too.
That's good. I think because sometimes I'm still like, you know, I sort of thirst for these books. I'm like, gosh, I'd really love, you know, this particular fairy story to be reimagined in middle grade or YA, or, you know, and when I find one that sounds exciting, I saw one today, I think it might be called Grimm's Forest or something like that, but it's Grimm inspired, but it sounds very different again, you know. And I love how they, you know, all these things, they're familiar, yet when they're also new and exciting as well.
Yes.
That's what's wonderful about them, you know. Yeah. Can be comforting and familiar, yet also feel like, oh, I've discovered something really new and exciting. And, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So you've done quite a few Russian-inspired stories now, but there's plenty more out there still to be done, let's be
honest.
Is, you know, it's a rich field that you can explore and other things. So what's next for you?
Definitely. My eldest actually said to me the other day, she said, are you going to get bored of doing, you know, Eastern European ones? What will you do next? And I said, well, no, I don't think I'll get bored. There's plenty. I'm halfway through writing one now that obviously I'm not allowed to talk about because publishing keeps everything a secret, but there is it's actually got a familiar character in it from one of my other books. So it's the first time that because all my books stand alone, they're all kind of linked in a way, but they all stand alone, but the one I'm working on now is perhaps more linked to another one of my books than any of the others has been, which is quite exciting. But I'll talk about what I might do after it, because I can talk more openly about that. Actually, what I was writing a reimagining of the Firebird. I finished the Snow Girl, and I thought, oh, I'll do the Firebird because it's fiery instead of snowy. It's a nice opposite. And I plotted it all out. I read everything I could read about the Firebird, plotted it all out. And then my editor got in touch with this other idea that I'm working on now. She said, oh, have you ever thought about doing this? I was like, oh, no, I haven't. But now you mention it, that sounds pretty cool. So the Firebird kind of got shelved. So I keep wondering if I'll go back to that. I do also, I would love to write an adult book one day. And I've been saying this for the last three books. I keep saying maybe the next one will be adult. And I don't know if it will be, but after the one I'm writing now, I'll be out of contract. And I do wonder if I might write an adult one. Possibly something Baba Yaga-ish in a, you know, for grown-ups, which does appeal to me, but I don't know. But I think I'll definitely stay with Eastern Europe for sure. And even if I try an adult one, I think I'll still keep my hand in children's fiction, because it's definitely my sweet spot as well. I do like writing for that age.
Yeah, and it has done you good service, and you know the awards and recognition and other things that your books have received show exactly why you should still continue writing children's fiction.
I've been very
well.
Lucky with all of that. Yes, indeed. They're
I don't think it's luck, hard. Sophie. I think your writing has quite a lot to do with it, to be honest. You know.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk about this one. Whatever you choose to write next after you're out of contract, whether it be children or adult, I'm sure it'll be amazing. And I shall look forward to the opportunity to chat about it with you in the future again. Yeah,
thank you so much. That would be lovely indeed. Thank you, Mark. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Thanks.
The Snow Girl is published by Usborne and can be found in various formats wherever books are sold. We'll close in a moment with an extract from the audiobook version. First, if you missed our announcements on social media and the podcast feed, then be aware that our new storytelling podcast, Stories from the Hearth, is now live on all podcast platforms. Each week, an old folk or fairy tale, sometimes classic but often obscure, is read for you in a book at bedtime style by one of our own folklore podcast listeners. You can find Stories from the Hearth on your podcast app. Just search for Stories from the Hearth, a folklore podcast production. We hope you enjoy it. Don't forget to rate and tell your friends if you do. My thanks to producer Tracy Nicholas for taking the helm of this show. If you'd like to read for us, then please email folklorepodreaders@gmail.com and we can give you more information. Don't forget that you can help us to keep making the content that we do by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. Tiers start at just £1 a month and everyone there gets extra content. You'll also find a donation button on our website. I'll be back with a new episode very soon. In the meantime, we end today with an extract from Sophie Anderson's book, The Snow Girl.
Tasha was untangling a baby goat from a bramble patch when the snow began to fall. The flakes were tiny at first, drifting through the cold, still air like flecks of dust. Unsure if it really was snow, Tasha placed the baby goat, who was called Ferdinand, down on a patch of grass. She slipped off one of her warm mittens, which were embroidered with woodland animals round the cuffs. Then she held out her hand. Glittering crystals landed on her skin, so softly she barely felt them, then disappeared instantly, as if soaking into her. "It's snowing," Tasha whispered, delight bubbling up inside her. Tasha had always dreamed of seeing snow. "It's snowing," she shouted louder, turning to the small stone farmhouse the other side of the goat paddock. The living room curtains were half drawn. Smoke curled sleepily from the chimney. Tasha put her hand over her mouth. She shouldn't have shouted. Grandpa was most likely dozing in front of the fire, and he needed his rest. And Mama and Papa would be busy, chopping wood or cutting hay, or packing turnips into straw. Tasha and her parents had moved to Grandpa's farm 3 months ago, because he was struggling to manage it alone, and there were 1,000 jobs to do to get it ready for winter, so shouting that it was snowing would not be helpful. Tasha turned away from the farmhouse and looked at the view all around. The mountains that cradled the patchwork valley were veiled by a cloud of falling snow, and the scattered handful of farmhouses that nestled among the fields were twinkling in the soft new light. Grandpa's valley was always quiet, but a deeper hush fell as the flakes grew larger. Within moments, they were as big as the letters in Mama's old nature books that Tasha read by lamplight in the long, dark nights.